then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, O O'Farrell, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. The date is Christmas Eve, Tuesday, December 24th, 2019. I'm Andy Donner, and you're listening to Radio Free Northwest.
We're watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon. And a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon.
Ladies and gentlemen, you will have noticed an obvious goof in our show scheduling, so I'll comment on it now and get that out of the way. This program should have been released at the end of last week, and the end-of-year music program should have been released later this week. Oops. And on that note, because we've probably given her a heart attack when she didn't hear her piece played, here's Gretchen discussing the Yule log.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to be printing a Christmas edition. It's not always easy to find really pertinent and Christmassy readings. So I decided to look for some stories having to do with the Yule log tradition. So the first story that I found was one entitled Burning the Yule Log by D. Jordan. At first, I thought this Christmas story had a lot of potential because it was a modern story with a lot of interesting themes. So a story about a middle-aged woman who's going through a very messy divorce, and she's also facing a health challenge. Her daughter comes home from college, and her daughter is exploring the Ozatro tradition. So she wants to get a Yule log from the forest. And so the story is about dragging this Yule log from the forest with horses. So apparently this family must be wealthy enough to have horses. The only problem with the story is that it's so brief that it feels really incomplete. Even though it promised to really be quite interesting, it ends up ending as if it was trying to be some sort of a commercial for the value of Christianity as opposed to paganism. However, I imagine that if someone took some of the seedlings of the story and actually wrote an entire book, which could potentially go in an entirely different direction, I could imagine this as a fascinating story. Because this story was all too brief, I went ahead and looked for another story, and I found one entitled When the Yule Log Burns by Lena Dalrymple. This is a country Christmas story that is extremely picturesque, and it's really very much like Currier and Ives. So it's a very Victorian type of story with very subtle writing. And even though it's a relatively short book, it requires a lot of careful reading because there are some secrets in the story that you don't learn until the end. So it's a very vivid story. I didn't feel that it pertained enough to us, but it was very charming. And I suppose if you want to read a charming Christmas story, that was one I would recommend. And then I found Round the Yule Log by Peter Christian Asbjornsen. And this is a story about brownies, trolls, and spirits. a series of stories, actually, and it's really the most traditional of all three. From there, I decided that the most interesting thing for this show would be to talk about the Yule log itself. Like a lot of things that get passed down through time and possibly become somewhat ritualistic, sometimes their origin is really shrouded in mystery. Some will even say the Yule log is a memory of a Celtic tradition from a time when religion might be said to be more visceral and perhaps called more primitive. But others say that it's really just a feudal invention having to do with making sure that people gather enough firewood. At any rate, there is a very strong tradition in the British Isles of saving the semi-burned log for the next year. And then the next year, the new Yule log is started with some remnants of the old Yule log. There are people who say that the Yule log tradition likely recalls a tradition of lighting bonfires. And the Yule log has to be lit once and thoroughly burned and then allowed, I suppose, to burn out, and it's unlucky to relight it. There's also a ritual revolving around the Yule log where candles are lit from the Yule log, and then a wish is made. It kind of reminds me of birthday wishes in a way. This wish is kept a secret. In addition to England, also in the Baltic, we have a log or a stump that is traditionally pulled through the village and then burned. Also, too, Jacob Grimm noted a South Slavic tradition that has to do with the burning of a sapling. And there's also a Spanish tradition where a Yule log is imagined to contain various candies and small gifts. Another interesting topic that was brought up in this book was the topic of brownies, who are apparently a kind of fairy. One of the things that they say about brownies, they say that at best they're helpful spirits and they help with things like farming and cleaning. It's said that brownies are happy to accept treats or possibly even a gift of linen, but what they really don't want is payment. Generally speaking, they'll run away if you try to pay them, although the tradition in Lincolnshire is slightly different. In Lincolnshire, apparently, you can pay brownies. In Denmark, there are spirits called the Nisser. They're very much like brownies, but these in particular are associated with Santa. Of course, that brings us to the question of trolls. And when I say trolls, I'm referring to the spirit-like creatures or the creatures that are really, in a way, kind of like gnomes. Of course, back in the 80s especially, you had, for example, troll dolls were very popular. Trolls are quite interesting, and they're associated with the night. They're said to be quite wild. There are stories about them fearing Thor's hammer because they're supposed to be afraid of either light or lightning. Sometimes they're said also to eat raw foods, and they're said to hoard treasure. The fascinating thing about this is the older I get, the more I suspect that these stories of trolls are actually some kind of a memory of the Neanderthals. This association with nighttime is quite interesting because I have read the theory that the Neanderthals may have hunted at night. There's also the belief that the Neanderthals had very strong immune systems, and at times they may have eaten raw foods, although they did have fire, so they could also have cooked things. So I'm guessing they would have done both. I don't think it was just one or the other. I tend to think that these are really Neanderthal creatures, especially when I consider the way they're always being portrayed in both sculpture and art. And of course, it's a very sort of exaggerated view. There was another theory that trolls may have simply been referenced to pagan groups, but I'm really not inclined to believe that because I get a sense that the difference with trolls seems to be more thorough than just a different religion. I hope you enjoyed this discussion. I know this is a bit different, but last year we had such a wonderful Christmas show, and I really wanted to find something that was Christmassy, and that's not always easy. But I hope you found this fun and seasonal. So have a good evening. Thank you for listening, and hail victory, comrades.
Comrades, we have received so many submissions that we put off a panel discussion we were going to play today in favor of a Radio Free Northwest contributor extravaganza. Even so, Jason and I will have a few comments today ourselves. I'm going to keep my remarks brief, because I don't want to take up more time than is absolutely necessary, as this is not an RFN regulars show. Even so, there are a few things I need to say. Someone sent in a question about the Northwest American Republic and monastic communities, and I'd actually like to answer that today, but I won't. I'm going to save that for another RFN show because I want to delve into how to apply sets of rules to questions you might come up with on the fly. More on that next year. Some weeks ago, I promised a physical mailing to all of our financial supporters of late. I have not yet accomplished this, but there's a good reason I'd like to talk to you all about that very briefly. Those of you who continue to interact with us are vitally important, and not just for financial reasons. We're looking at automating quite a bit of the communication that we can't make electronic, and automating even more of our electronic communication simply because we need to get better at what we're doing. Those of you who continue to provide us this opportunity are making sure we get better at it. We appreciate you in many more ways than you might think. Please keep it up. Lastly, someone recently asked for a party update since there are no more RFNs. Well, as it so happens, there are, and we told you that there would be. Even so, it's a very valid question, and I will give you my update, short as it is. Later in this program, Jason will have his own items to mention. Much of my time has been spent on projects I can't talk to you about yet, but I've also spent time thinking about next year's Radio Free Northwest content. Above all else, the Northwest Front has an immediate responsibility to make sure as many white nationalists as possible are not deceived into supporting Donald Trump again on the basis that he's going to make progress or a difference for our race in this country. He can't because such a thing was necessary and only possible decades ago. We're well past that point, and Harold told you as much when he was alive prior to Trump's election. That being the case, I need to spend a certain amount of time, maybe more time than I'm thinking right now, explaining to each and every one of you why it is that system politics will doom the white race. It's been explained before, but we actually have very good examples now in the form of Donald Trump. I absolutely have to capitalize on this because as many white nationalists as possible must not go into the next election thinking they're doing our race a favor by propping up the failed multiracial empire that America turned into. It's been dead a long time, guys. We're just now watching it rot. The faster you all internalize that and give up on this Trump nonsense, the faster we can get on track for the creation of the Northwest American Republic so that we can secure the existence of our people and a future for white children.
Greetings, everyone. This is Comrade Jason. I hope everyone is having a fantastic Christmas and Yule holiday season. My segment for this RFN is going to be short, but that's okay, since so many of you have stepped up to the plate over the past 2 months and responded to our call for submissions to the show. This time, I want to start off with a report of a meeting I and Comrade AJ had with another young couple here in the homeland last week. What is significant about this meeting is that these folks are in the headquarters region of the Puget Sound, the place where we need our migrants to focus on settling to help begin to build the front up in earnest in our main operational area in the homeland. These good and loyal young whites are in their early 20s, and what they had to say gives us hope for our younger generations. One is a family member of a longtime party associate and has long been informed by his family of the path the white race is currently barreling down and the need to work to reverse our course, and he has stepped up to take his place at the table to work toward that goal. His lovely better half is a convert to the cause, a refugee from the narcissistic and childish worldview of the left. But the impressive thing is that she converted herself to the racial loyalist and white nationalist worldview through simple, honest observation and her own good sense. Many people simply think their way to a proper understanding of the world and reach the right conclusions based upon what they see, and this young lady has done precisely that. We congratulate them both and welcome them to our ranks. They had some very interesting things to say as members of the youngest currently recognized generation, Generation Z. They report that their contemporaries are highly attuned to the severe and almost unbridgeable schism that the communist anti-white left has injected into the heart of America, and that the topic of the almost inevitable coming civil war in this nation is very much on their minds. They say that in their circles, their friends, acquaintances, and coworkers of their own age talk about it almost daily. They also confirmed to us what several news outlets have been reporting over the past couple of years, that Gen Z is more conservative than any recent generation in America. The people of their age group they come across in their work and in daily life are mostly right of center, they report, which is obviously a good thing for us. Despite the leftist insanity that is rife on our college campuses, off of them, our young folks seem to be turned off by a lot of the emotionally childish and disturbed propaganda and policies of the left. We can obviously use this as we go forward, and we shall. Now a little on our current media output. As far as original content and analysis goes, we are obviously putting out less now than before. I do want to reassure the Front's listeners and donors that the time and effort that has previously been dedicated to propaganda efforts through RFN is indeed going to other aspects of party building, and some results of that we will be able to share with you in the coming months. In the meantime, in case you are needing a greater fix than the Front currently provides, I want to direct your attention to another source of excellent white nationalist content on the net. For a long while, we have had communication established between ourselves and Radio Aryan, now called Radio Albion, run by Sven Longshanks out of the UK. Sven and his crew host Radio Free Northwest on their site and report download numbers that effectively double our listeners and reach, especially with our brothers and sisters in our ancestral home countries of Europe. Radio Aryan, a couple months back, became Radio Albion, using the oldest known name for the Isle of Great Britain. In the Britain of today, which is so against the white man's freedom of speech, this change was made to allow easier cooperative efforts within Radio Albion's reach on the other side of the pond. But the change is finalized now, and for all the excellent content Sven produces and links to, you just need to search for them under their new name. I don't know how they are so prolific in their production of content, but their efforts and their product are truly impressive. Sven and his compatriots, Grandpa Lampshade, Dennis Wise, and others, provide first-rate and highly informative content that matches anything you will find anywhere. Right now, they have on their site excellent recaps on the overwhelming Tory victory in the recent elections, which will finally allow the government to deliver on Brexit, in line with the will of the people to take sovereignty of their country and control of their borders back from the European Union. Go give Radio Albion a listen, especially if you like to keep up on developments in Europe and the UK. They definitely deserve your attention and listenership. That's all I have for you this time, comrades, but as always, I'm pleased to talk with you again. I hope you all have a Merry Christmas and Happy Yule, and I will have more for you next time on the other side of the new year, in 2020. Hail victory!
By yon bonny banks and by yon bonny braes, where the sun shines bright on Loch Lomond, where me and my true love will never meet again, or on the bonny, bonny banks of Loch Lomond. Oh, you take the high road and I'll take the low road, and I'll be in Scotland afore ye. But me and my true love will never meet again on the bonny, bonny banks of Loch Lomond. Was there that that we parted in yon shady glen, on the steep, steep sides of Ben Lomond, where in soft purple hue the highland hills we view, and the moon coming out in the glow.
What is the one big secret that powerful people don't want us to know?
It's who and how they create the money.
That's quite right. They don't want us to know how money is created or by whom. You know, we spent all our lives working for this money. And in fact, we're working harder and harder and longer for less and less of it. Since the 1950s, the amount of free time we have has diminished by about 50%. And we have more families working, which is brings us back to the early days of the Industrial Revolution. More family members working. Wives are working. Even teenage kids have to spend a lot of time working. You remember the Leave It to Beavers? Those kids right. didn't have to do anything after school. Now kids just have to work after school to pay the debts.
It used to be called the American Dream.
Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, yeah. yes. And George Carlin's famous comment, right now you'd want to be asleep to believe it. And that's very, very sad. But as hard as people work, right, they don't really know what they're working for. Now, all of us know a lot of things that money does, but very few of us know what money really is. We endure, and that's about the right word, about 15,000 hours of compulsory schooling. And we all sit supposedly being informed by television, the sea of lies, for even longer than that. But both these institutions, far from informing us, go to great trouble and lengths to give us the impression that money is something far different from what it really is.
Right.
Now, the secret of money is this. When you think you're borrowing money from a bank, the bank doesn't really give you anything. What the bank does is takes your own promise to pay and creates brand new money out of that. Then it takes ownership of this new money and lends it back to you at interest. So how can a bank do this, right? It's because of the fact that a bank's note is accepted as money by business and by other banks. And that's all a checkbook is, folks, is a note from the bank.
The acceptable promissory note to pay.
Exactly. Yep. But suppose by a massive confidence trick, right, that my note was equally acceptable around the community and you want to buy a house. So I write $200,000 on a piece of paper, sign it, and give it to you. Now, because of the confidence trick, the owner of the house agrees to take my piece of paper in exchange for his house. And supposing you agree that you pay me back the money I gave you, plus interest, by paying me, let's say, $1,500 every month for the next 30 years. I've done pretty well out of this.
Absolutely. Getting money for nothing.
Yeah. You've just agreed to give me about $400 worth of your labor every week, and all I've given you is a piece of paper with my name on it. Now, that's exactly how a modern bank works. Partly by their special confidence trick and partly by collusion with the government, their pieces of paper are regarded as good for paying debts and taxes. Then by making other means of exchange inconvenient or even impossible, certainly unenforceable, they force us to use their paper all the time, and we have to pay for this paper with real work.
As we see, like, throughout history, we've seen a further centralization of this system throughout the world now, to where essentially the banking system operates as one big world bank. Originally each state had its own banking system, for instance, and its own currencies. But now we see this acceptable promissory note to pay throughout the world. You can go to anywhere and just basically draw up a check in any bank, whatever country you're going into, and there's this collusion between the coercive power and the banking system.
No question, because in order to pull off a confidence trick of this magnitude, the banks have to work really closely together. And as you put it, the banking system operates as one bank. You can write out a check here on Wells Fargo Bank, and you can cash it just as easily in Bank of America. You can write out a check for Wells Fargo Bank in Seattle and cash it in Florida. The banking system operates as one very tightly managed unity, and that's the only way the confidence trick would work. Now, since paper is really cheap and people's labor will always be very valuable, banks want to issue as much of their paper as they're allowed to, and this drives up the price of everything we buy, especially the cost of the house we live in, and that's what's known as inflation. So now, in order to buy essential items like homes and cars, we have to take out these so-called loans from the green paper suppliers and dedicate most of the hours we work every day to paying them off. The best name for this condition is debt serfdom, because it's a kind of involuntary servitude, a kind of forced labor.
And we see that the more that the central banking system floods the country with these creating money out of thin air, with all these green pieces of paper we call the dollar bill, that's right on the top of got Federal Reserve note. The system is awash with printed money, and this is why it drives up the inflation within the country. You're seeing gas prices go up, you're seeing food prices, everything's going up. And this is why every time we have this type of economic problem, the bubble gets bigger and bigger and bigger, because the system is awash with more money.
And it's a kind of debt money, and debt, folks, is forced labor. And not surprisingly, this forced labor has come to dominate our lives. Now, 70% of our waking hours we spend working, going to work, coming from work, preparing for work, and recovering from work. And if that's not bad enough, 70% of the money we earn is taken from us in debt repayments and taxes. Now, guess what? The debt serf today is in exactly the same position as the land serf was in the Middle Ages. The land serf also had to spend about 70% of his at least daylight hours, which were less than his waking hours, working for the lord of the manor. And 70% of his produce was taken by the lord for using the lord's land. This was because the lord of the manor assumed ownership of the land cultivated by the serf, and in the same way that a modern bank assumes ownership of the new debt money that the borrower literally works into existence. Now, we're better off than the medieval serf in one respect. The houses we buy with this debt money are far more comfortable than the little place he lived in. But we are worse off than he didn't have to devote anything like as much of his time to toil and forced labour. Contrary to what a lot of people have been led to assume, the medieval serf had plenty of leisure time. You know, even slaves in southern plantations before the Civil War had plenty of leisure time.
Yeah.
But we have been deprived of most of our leisure time. It's been decimated in the all in the last 50 years. We have little or none.
Oh, but we don't live in mud huts anymore.
No, you know,
but we're still slaves.
I think I'd much rather
economic slaves.
I'd much rather live in a smaller house and give me back my precious time. But since 1960, the amount of time the average American spends working has increased by 30%. And at the same time, the amount of his leisure time has decreased by over 50%. And I think even that figure is understated because it doesn't take into account the fact that in 1960, his wife in all probability did no extra work outside the home. And if we calculate the hours that each family spends on toil, the amount has more than doubled. I'll just give you an example of that. In the 1950s, a house cost about 2 years' wages, maybe even less. So only the husband had to work. In the 1970s, a house was around 3 to 3.5 years' wages. So in a typical family, the husband had to work full-time and the wife had to work part-time. By the year 2006, when house prices were most inflated with his debt money, a house cost 8, 9, 10 years' wages. So in a typical family, the husband had to work, the wife had to work full-time, and the teenage children had to provide about one other labour unit between them. If there were two or three, they had to work maybe 15, 20 hours a week, each teenager, so that there were three full-time adults working just to pay off their debts and survive. Now, this is frightening.
Yeah, it is. It, you know, it really, this answers the question. I hear a lot of people ask me, well, how come we don't have this standard of living in America anymore that we were used to in the 50s. They don't quite understand where it's all gone, how it's just slipped through the fingers. And of course, this is it. And if anybody has not read the book, I would thoroughly recommend George Orwell's 1984, where he uses the whole idea of a farm and he uses animals to explain the whole system that we live under. And in essence, if you read that book, you will see that you've got a lot in common, folks. We have a lot in common with Boxer the horse because they just want to work us to death till we drop. And that's it. And of course, the pigs in the farm eventually turn into men. They start standing up, and that's what we've seen. We've seen all these people that they might have started out with good intentions, but they're turning into something that they're clearly not. They're turning into the same beast as their money masters are.
Absolutely. And as the amount of debt money increases, the quantity of debt money goes up, our poverty goes up, and the amount of time we spend working goes up. Now, in a country with the enormous, and I mean enormous, productive capacity that the United States has, how come we're getting poorer and poorer? Our credit card bills are going up every month. Our cars are getting older. And the reason is the monetary system we have. We have a privately issued debt money system. It doesn't matter how hard we work. It doesn't matter how good your business ideas are. If a private group of people can issue all the money in circulation, all our ideas, all our efforts are going to be channeled to these people and we're going to be poorer and poorer.
And what was it that Baron von Rothschild said back in the over 100 years ago?
Give me control of the nation's money supply. I don't care who makes the laws.
Exactly. And of course, he was playing games and they were playing chess and creating wars and controlling central banks in Europe long before this country was even its own country.
No.
And of course, this is they've now extended it to where they've pretty much got us now on our knees in the new world.
This new world order of forced labor, because that's what debt is, folks. Debt is forced labor. Let's go back to the Middle Ages, to the origin of our modern banking system. You know, that time in the Middle Ages, the safest place to keep gold, and money usually meant gold or silver in those days, the safest place to keep that was usually the vault owned by the local goldsmith. And when a goldsmith routinely stored people's gold for a fee, by degrees he became a banker. Now, when somebody deposited his gold in this vault, the goldsmith gave him a note for its value. Now, a goldsmith's note could always be redeemed for the value of the gold it represented. So it could be used as a form of currency, a form of exchange. It could not, however, be broken down into smaller amounts. Now, this represented a problem for someone who wished, for example, to have his roof redone. This was a job that had to be done about every 30 years. And while it cost more than the coins that a householder carried about with him, it wouldn't cost his entire life savings, and if he did, the job would probably be put off. So the owner had to go to the goldsmith, who, again for a fee, would take the note, give him some gold and a note for a smaller amount. Then the owner paid the roofer with the gold. Now, so far, there was nothing unjust in this, but with the invention of printing and mass duplication, everything changed.
Greetings, comrades. This is the Count of Lettuce. I'd like to start my contribution by thanking the fine people at RFN for allowing my contributions. It's an honor, and I'll try to keep on doing them. Now, on to the topic I'd like to discuss. It has become very clear for a while that conservatives are incapable of preserving our civilization. This is also the case whenever a movement seems to rise and oppose globalism and the current madness destroying our race. Soon thereafter, the movement gets derailed and co-opted by kikes or any other puppets. However, recently, it seems that things are starting to become so transparent that our folk are able to see through their deception. And I have to say, I feel there is a case to be made that these changes are only going to bring more attention to the topics of white genocide, white separatism, and eventually the Northwest Front. Let me start by summarizing some of the recent events in the young quote-unquote conservative spaces and how these talking heads have been peddling the same lies and useless rhetoric. For instance, there is a somehow influential Jew on the internet by the name of Ben Shapiro. He prides himself on having a strong discourse skill, which he uses to denounce the absurdity of the far left. Shapiro himself is an Orthodox Jew and a supporter of Donald Trump, rightfully so, as the current president gives more help to Israel than entire continents. This kike has been featured in mainstream media as the champion of American conservatism. Can you imagine? He pretends to oppose all the ills that his people have inflicted upon our race. Another Jew by the name of Dennis Prager has started an online movement called PragerU. He hosts several conservative talking heads that denounce in a similar fashion the lunacy of gender ideology, cultural Marxism, and the threat of Islam. Again, he forgets to mention that Jews are the ones opening the gates of white countries to Arabs and Niggers. These characters are nothing more than gatekeepers. They tell our rightfully angered youth that the enemy is somewhere else, and that all that matters is that we preserve our principles, regardless of race. But of course, this cannot be further from the truth. But to the young and impressionable, this is an evil tactic of deceit. They act as gatekeepers, preventing our people from finding the truth. As I recall from one of Harold's episodes of RFN, and recently brought to my attention by a comment I read from Comrade Jason, the two real problems are the Jew and our own character flaws as whites. The rest are consequences of these two. You will never hear any conservative speak with such rightful wisdom. What kosher conservatism does is equivalent to prescribing an aspirin when the patient is in need of surgery. If we cannot find the root of the problem, we cannot even name the problem, how are we supposed to find the solution? And these evil merchants of lies know it. That's why they're active in these conservative circles. Kikes like Ben Shapiro, Dennis Prager, Ezra Levant from the so-called rebel media in Canada, and so many others. Now, they are not all kikes, of course. They have their Gentiles as well doing work for them. It came to my attention a so-called conservative movement, Turning Point USA, I believe is named. They are nothing more than kosher conservatives, of course, and they repeat the same pointless lies. But they also go one step closer to insanity. In one of their conferences, in which they were presenting their ideas on how to win the quote-unquote cultural war against the left, the leader of this movement, a self-hating white by the name of Charlie Kirk, went so far as to appeal to the sexual perverts in the so-called LGBTQ community in an effort to try to portray conservatism as some kind of twisted lefty ideology that now becomes all-inclusive. Needless to say, the vast majority of the audience immediately realized the whole thing was a sellout, nothing more than controlled opposition, just like Donald Trump. But of course, in the case of this Turning Point USA movement, they were even going a step further, as I said, where they're promoting the most decadent behavior amongst the so-called conservatives. It was truly astonishing. But that's not all. During the Q&A session, the presenters were repeatedly hammered with questions about demographics, the Jewish control of the media, and in those questions, young and conservative whites were generally asking, how can we stop our countries from being overrun by people from the third world? The answers of these pathetic talking heads were all the same false ideas, pushing their lies, saying it's all about ideas, not race. Yet we know that once a place becomes overrun by spics, cooks and niggers, it becomes a lefty dystopia, a multicultural shithole, as it happened in California and recently in Virginia, or in the case of Europe, when a city becomes overrun by mudskins such as Paris, London, Frankfurt, and many others. They never stop voting left, which in the case of Europe is the Social Democrats. In other words, we obviously know this, but they are still trying to hide it. It always is a matter about race. But the good part of all of this is that our young folk are more prone to asking questions that terrify the establishment. That was especially the case when they asked about Israel, and why is it that we never ask the dual loyalties of their citizens, we never question them, or policies that can damage the interests of white Americans in favor of Israel. It was absolutely encouraging to see our young men and women bringing into the mainstream politics topics that would otherwise remain unspoken, and that is why I believe there is reason to be cautiously optimistic. Similarly to this shield of Charlie Kirk and all the kikes, there is a Texas representative by the name of Dan Crenshaw. He has been portrayed as a young Republican and the face of the new conservative movement. Same story here, really. He avoids questions using blatantly stupid arguments when it comes to questioning dual loyalties and the hyped importance of Israel to the average white person. In one particular event he held in a university, students, mostly white, of course, were in line and ready to ask questions during the Q&A session. It became really obvious that these white guys were going to put this idiot Crenshaw to shame and expose further his hypocrisy. Yet as the first question was asked, and he started babbling nonsense, members of his staff were pushing out of the queue the white kids and only letting through pre-selected members of the audience, asking irrelevant questions about taxes and other nonsense. The white kids immediately realized this was totally a farce. This event, I believe, was live-streamed, and some of these young lads were running their own streams. And in those streams, they were asking questions anyway, regardless if this idiot of Crenshaw was listening or not. They were asking amongst themselves and shouting into the speaker. Again, they were questioning demographics, the importance of race, and the Jewish interference in conservative movements. Our folk are waking up faster at this rate, thanks to the blatant lies and obvious Jewish subversion. From my personal point of view, I can tell that there are three main pillars of truth that led me to find the Northwest Front. These are race realism, also known as a demographic question. As Comrade Jason said before, there is no equality when it comes to the human races. This is self-evident and has been for our whole history, up until the last 60 or so years ago. Just as the natural world has its own hierarchies and differences between the species and different levels of development, the same holds true for us humans. Why else would mudskins rush into white countries seeking welfare? In spite of all the wars and devastation, Europe and Europeans, wherever they are, manage to thrive in their environments. Our unique qualities make us who we are. This is self-evident. The second pillar of truth is gender realism. Jordan Peterson, a Canadian clinical psychologist, has addressed this issue at length, and I do believe he makes a good job at it. Comrade Jason also talked about him in a previous episode of RFN. The third pillar of truth is the JQ, or Jewish question. History is full of examples of how their corrosive and destructive nature has undermined entire nations. From the Moor invasion into Visigothic Iberia, the Judeo-Bolshevik Revolution of Russia. Why do you think they were kicked out of dozens of nation-states throughout history? These three pillars of truth will give our folk the knowledge they seek. Once they realize the truth, there will be no turning back. They will be coming to our side. I can tell you this, the more they keep peddling their lies, the more likely it is that we will reach the tipping point. I might be slightly naive, I recognize it, but I do feel a change is coming. More and more people are not afraid to talk about the differences in race, gender, and about the destructive influence of Jews in our societies. I believe the winds are in our favor. These young kids are finding the truth. It won't be long before they start hearing from the Northwest Front and come to the right conclusion that this is the only viable plan to save our people. We will come together and rekindle the flame of our civilization. It is only a matter of time and dedication. I will sign off with a Crusader song from the former Kingdom of Burgundy, composed by Guillaume de Dijon. This song is a plea from a fair maiden, asking the Lord to grant her strength to endure the absence of her beloved husband, and to grant him his protection against the wicked Saracens in the noble endeavor of retaking the Holy Land. This is Estampi performing Chanterai pour mon courage.
Thank you. What or who is an American? The first Americans left Plymouth on the Mayflower, first to Holland to pick up others, and then on to America. They left because the Church of England had made it a felony to be found in possession of a Geneva Bible, the first printed Bible written in English. The Geneva Bible was being smuggled into England in 1608. By 1619, the Thirty Years' War had started in Europe. Tyndale, the author of the Geneva Bible, was burned to death at the stake in Holland by the Roman Catholic Church. Back in those days, you could be burned to death for being in possession of a Bible, and by churches that call themselves Christian. The Church of England in America is now known as Episcopalian. The Irish Massacre of 1643, where 40,000 Protestants were massacred by the Roman Catholic, led to the English Civil War between the Roundheads and the Royalists, won by the Roundheads under Oliver Cromwell and the Puritans, the very same people who fled to America. Now, a little over 100 years later, we have the American Revolution, inspired by Thomas Paine, an Englishman. Thomas Paine was the son of a Quaker. The American Revolution was just a repeat of the English Civil War. On the British side, you had those that supported the King, George III, so you may as well call them Royalists. And on the American side, the Protestants, who were saying, "Give me liberty or give me death." After the Civil War was over, Oliver Cromwell wrote a constitution for England, and in it he wrote, "The right of Protestants to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." However, the British restored the monarchy, and we all know which country followed Oliver Cromwell. Gun control is always followed by a massacre. This is the findings of a study by a professor from the University of Hawaii. And who is it that does the massacre? Your government. We have had massacres in this country, such as Ruby Ridge, Waco, Oklahoma City, and Vegas. And who is the main suspect? And what about 9/11? Government records were kept in Building 7, and which building collapsed without being hit by an aeroplane? Since America was established by people escaping from religious persecution, therefore no member of a persecuting religion deserves to be called an American. The Roman Catholic order known as the Jesuits started the communists on May 1, 1776. A church that would outlaw translating the Bible into a common language does not deserve to be called a Christian church. Belonging to a religion that calls for the extermination of non-believers does not deserve to be practiced in America. Such a religion allows non-believers to exist if they pay protection money. In Islam, it is called the jizya. MS-13 is already murdering homeless people in L.A. that do not pay protection money. Now what about another religion, the Jews? Judaism is another persecuting religion. They have passed a law in Israel that if a Jew converts to Christianity, they face a 20-year jail sentence. Also, Judaism is an immoral religion, whereby a Jew is only required to observe principles of morality towards other Jews. In conclusion, to keep America as a free country, only free people can become its citizens. All those that want to import religious traditions that lead to slavery or ignorance or gangsterism have to be excluded by the Constitution. Civil War II. You can fool some of the people all the time and all the people some of the time, but you cannot deceive all of the people all of the time. Abraham Lincoln. Only 4% of Americans still believe in the mainstream media. Censorship only proves beyond a reasonable doubt that you are being ruled by criminals. The outlawing of arms against law-abiding citizens by the government only proves beyond a reasonable doubt that you are being ruled by gangsters. The FBI, as a result of trying to frame people in the Trump administration for 2 years, has lost all credibility and belief in it to be a law enforcement agency. They spent $40 million of your taxpayers' money and came up empty. Socialists believe the state is a substitute for God. Consequently, you'll lose all your first 10 amendments to the Constitution under any form of socialism. On May 1, 1776, the Communist Party was started by a Jesuit. At that time, the Jesuits had been outlawed by the Catholic Church. The purpose of the Society of Jesus, or Jesuits, was to abolish the Protestant Reformation. Guy Fawkes was a Jesuit who tried to blow up the Houses of Parliament in England. They seek to abolish government for and by the people. Communism seeks to abolish government for and by the people and replace it with a tyranny by the state. Bankers such as Rothschild supported the Communist Party from the beginning and still do. The siege of 100 Sydney Street took place in London, England, in 1910, when Winston Churchill was the Minister for the Home Office, the Attorney General in America. The anarchist who managed to escape fled to America and moved to the Gig Harbor area. That is why a road near Gig Harbor is called Sydney Street. Anarchists from the town of Holme assassinated President McKinley. The history of the Second Amendment. After winning the English Civil War against the Royalist Catholics, Oliver Cromwell wrote a constitution for England, and in it he wrote, "The right of Protestants to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." The real threat to freedom is always religious freedom. Communists hate religious freedom, whether that is Christianity, Buddhism, or any other religion. Today, the communists have joined forces with Islam, so that Islam has become the greatest threat to religious freedom. Back in 1608, the Geneva Bible was being smuggled into England. It was a felony to be found in possession of such a Bible. Back in those days, you could be burned to death at the stake. In order to escape from such religious persecution, the pilgrims left Plymouth in 1619. In 1643, about 40,000 Protestants were massacred by the Roman Catholic Church and became known as the Irish Massacre, which was supported by the King of England. This led to the English Civil War. The King lost and was beheaded in Whitehall, which is next to Downing Street. Now, a little over 100 years later, the same people who fought the English Civil War, the Protestants, started the American Revolution. Protestant pastor was the leader of the shootout that took place on Lexington Green. England does not have the freedom of speech. England has become a tyranny. Tommy Robinson has been imprisoned for exercising the freedom of speech against Islam. What causes people to become angry enough to engage in a mass killing? If you abuse the lowest IQ people, such as people in America that are in special education, then such people are more likely to retaliate than people with a high IQ. Low IQ white people in no way, shape, or form consider themselves to be in any way privileged. The lower the IQ, the more likely they will retaliate and use violence. Our jails are full of low IQ people. They watch cartoons. If the liberals continue to preach white privilege and continue their unjustified attacks of racism against the white race, then the lowest IQ members will become mass killers. Both recent killers were of low IQ. The importance of religion to the Republic. We are evolutionists. That means we believe that biological evolution determines our civilization. In short, the disappearance of the white race will lead to the world being ruled by the second most evolved race, the Asian race, and in particular, China. Religion is a choice, whereas one's biology is not. We choose religion because of our biology. The noble race, or in Sanskrit, the Aryan race, does not choose a religion that is not noble. Therefore, in order to protect the citizens from barbarism and crime, the Aryan Republic must outlaw and prohibit the presence of barbaric religions. The highest caste in Hinduism is the Aryan race. A member of this caste began teaching the most important philosophy, which means love of wisdom, that is, the right viewpoint. His name was Buddha. The second teaching is right action. We have a religion in the West that forbids uncivilized behavior, known as the Ten Commandments, so that the purpose of religion is to create a civilized society. However, some religions do not lead to a civilized society. A religion that does not lead to a civilized society will have to be outlawed from an Aryan republic. From John Adams, he wrote, "Our Constitution was made for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate for the government of any other." And this is Ronald Reagan. He said, "Freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it to our children in the bloodstream. The only way we can inherit the freedom we have known is if we fight for it, protect it, defend it, and then hand it on to them to do the same."
Radio Free Northwest is brought to you by the Northwest Front, P.O. Box 2188, Bremerton, Washington, 98310. You can visit the party on our website at www.northwestfront.org. Until next time, comrades, hail victory.